Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. In about 30 minutes, the Senate Judiciary Committee will vote on Judge Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court. A yes vote, and that is what we are expecting, would then move the debate over to the full Senate. We will switch over to NPR's live coverage. We just got the news about the timing, so unfortunately, we only have a short time with our guests. Helene Olin is a contributor to the Plum Line blog and author of the book Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Hi, Helene. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Great to have you. Sarah Posner is an investigative reporter, a reporting fellow at the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, and author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Hi, Sarah. Thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me again, Rose.
And Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewire, an online publication focused on health, rights, and justice. She also founded and directed the Center for Health and Gender Equity, an organization that monitors the effects of U.S. international policy on reproductive and sexual health and rights. Hi, Jody. Thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Hey. I should mention I'm with Rewire.news.
Rewire.news. Thank you. We forgot the .news. Thank you. And an incredible website that follows what's going on right now. Well, since we only have a short time with all of you, I want to dive in and let's first talk about how you think the media are covering all of the survivors that are being re-traumatized by all of this and are sharing their stories. When we cut into yesterday's hearings twice, we had caller after caller after caller who either were sharing their story with our audience or sharing it for the first time. So, Helene, what are your thoughts? How do you think the media are covering that really important angle?
I think it's something that has actually taken almost everybody by surprise, and I don't know why it has taken us all by surprise, and I will say I am as guilty as anybody else. It seems to have come as a wave, and I think the media, for the most part, is so concentrating on what's going on in Washington that this is still something of a side note as to how it's actually impacting individual women.
Sarah, what are your thoughts?
I think that everyone was so focused on what Dr. Ford's testimony would be that they lost sight of the fact that there would be millions of women who would be reliving a trauma, reliving their high school days, reliving their college days. And I think, like Helene says, it's a bit of like an avalanche of what's coming at us now from people who found themselves in that position after yesterday or during yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Jody?
Can you repeat the question, Rose? I'm having a lot of feedback for some reason on the call.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. We'll try to figure out
That's why.
I just wonder, what do you think about the media covering how traumatic this is for so many people? Survivors are having to relive their trauma. And then when we cut into the hearings yesterday twice, we had caller after caller who wanted to share their story, and so many shared it for the first time during our show. So what do you think about the coverage of those important stories?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, for one thing, in some ways, as painful as it is, it's incredibly important also that these stories do come out. I mean, there were people calling C-SPAN yesterday offering their stories of sexual assault and abuse, and I think one reason it's important that it does come out is because it makes clear that these things are prevalent, that they happen to many women and men and children, and that we need to address it. And I think it begins, like with abortion or anything else, the more you talk about it, the more you are able to tell your personal story, the more you are able to take away the stigma and allow others to come forward. So I do think, you know, I tend to think of these kinds of things coming in large historical waves. And I don't think any one historical wave necessarily washes away the bad. So I know that we are 30 years out or however many years out from Anita Hill, and I know that so much has not changed, but I think we're in a new place now and we are galvanized for change, especially given the political and electoral landscape. So I think there's something happening now that media coverage may or may not be helping, depending on what part of the media you're listening to, but that nonetheless may in fact be building a bigger wave in many ways than we've seen before for change.
And we should also note that when Senator Jeff Flake said that he's going to vote yes, a woman basically cornered him in an elevator and said, that's what you're telling all women in America, that they don't matter. They should just keep it to themselves. So, I mean, people are going to be, trying to confront these politicians. Let's talk about what happened yesterday. Senator Dianne Feinstein said that, you know, everybody has made up their mind before the testimony, specifically the Republicans. Helene, what really stood out for you in the hearing yesterday and the way that the media covered it?
I actually want to go back to one thing you just mentioned before I answer that question, is I think for a long time we've allowed the Republican Party in particular to get away with a lot of moralizing tripe, sort of idea that like Jeff Flake's speech on Wednesday, right, that, you know, they are giving this serious consideration and, you know, this is, you know, a great moral issue. And then when push comes to shove, of course, you know, Jeff Flake says, oh, I'm going to vote for him, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this is something that needs to be called out again and again. And I think one of the things that has changed, and I think this nomination has somehow finally broken through on it. I mean, I think it's been a slow buildup through the entire Trump administration, but this seems to have brought it to a crescendo, is that people are not standing, especially women, are not standing for this anymore, that they will call people out and they will confront them over this. And I think you saw that in the elevator exchange that went viral this morning.
Mm.
And I think this is an important point to make. For me, what stood out yesterday is the whole thing was a horror show to watch, right, from beginning to end. From Christine Blasey Ford's pain to how she felt she needed to be accommodating to the Senate and tried to be a good girl, as I put it in my column, to, Brett Kavanaugh's just almost untrammeled rage. But I think the thing that really stood out to me was the sheer disrespect he showed, especially to female senators. And I think it was something that was really telling about how he feels about women and women's issues and women in general. And I just couldn't stop thinking about that after I saw that.
What about you, Sarah? What stood out for you and what are your thoughts about how the media covered the hearing?
So I thought that I agree with everything that Helene said. But I would also add that I think what really surprised, you know, what you might call the mainstream media, so like, you know, reporters who write for, who cover the news as opposed to writing opinion pieces for outlets like the Washington Post or the New York Times or Bloomberg or Politico, I think what seemed to surprise them in real time, like if you were watching social media as the hearing was playing out, was Kavanaugh's anger and just how angry and bad if he was and how unbecoming that was and really out of line for someone who's nominated to the highest court, and how that was completely at odds with his self-description in the original part of his confirmation hearings as an impartial judge who would never take into account any, you know, personal ideology or anything like that, and how he came in there guns a-blazing and just like angry and really dripping with rage.
Yeah.
And I think for reporters who are used to covering official Washington and used to covering, oh, you know, the Senate is going to have a vote on this and they're following this rule and that rule and this protocol and this custom and this tradition, to see that happen, I think, was incredibly stunning. And to see the disrespect he leveled at the Democratic senators, and in particular the female Democratic senators. That exchange that he had with Senator Klobuchar after she recounted her father's alcoholism and how her father is in recovery, so she understands alcoholism, and she asked him if he had ever drank to such a degree in college that he blacked out, which obviously like is a relevant question to his memory of these events in question. And he shot back at her, did you? And it was just so, I think everyone was just completely stunned. And I think that for the mainstream media to see that and to see like these norms being just shattered by male rage, not by female rage, it's the male rage that's shattering the norms, I think hopefully, was a big wake-up call as far as what's going on more broadly in the Trump administration.
Right. I mean, I would love to know who coached him and what was the decision behind that to just, as you said, go in with guns a-blazing. Jody, what are your thoughts?
So, picking up on a few things that both Sarah and Helene have said, you know, there was an incident that happened about not a year ago, probably about 9 months ago, where Addie Barkan, who is a an activist who has ALS, confronted Jeff Flake on a plane back to Arizona. And Addie has ALS, and it was just on the eve of one of the healthcare votes. And he videotaped a conversation with Jeff Flake where he was basically saying, "I will be dying very soon, and if you take away this health care, I may not have the money to get the oxygen I need to see my son that much longer." It was an extremely painful and very riveting exchange. And it reminded me yesterday of Flake getting in the elevator and having this woman confront him with the story of her sexual assault. And I think those two instances are pivotal instances both in what the media does and does not cover and what alternative media, if you will, or sort of movement media is covering. Because if you listen, as I do too often, to Inside the Beltway media or, you know, Washington-focused media, they do play to, as Sarah said, you know, what's going on in the Senate and what is the scorekeeping and that kind of thing. And those things have always left out people. They've always left out people. They've been deals between senator to senator, not what my constituents need versus what your constituents need. And I think there's some shattering of those quote-unquote norms or the sort of, you know, encasement of the Senate that needs to happen to some degree as these activists and other people really are bringing real people into the discussion in the moment and putting pressure on the senators. I'm not sure the media has effectively started to cover that very tension that's happening with all of the people that are becoming active. To some degree they do, but I don't think enough. And I think it's those pivotal moments where Jeff Flake is in an elevator and can't even look this woman in the eye or won't even answer Addie Barkan to say what will happen to his life, that you see that these people are so very sheltered from reality, it begins to bring home the kinds of changes we need.
Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewired.News. Sarah Posner is an investigative reporter. Helene Olin is a contributor to the Washington Post's Plumline blog. And this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. In about 10 minutes, we are going to head over to NPR's live coverage. The Senate Judiciary Committee will vote on Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court. A yes vote, which is what we're expecting, would then move the debate over to the full Senate. So, unfortunately, we only have about 10 minutes left. Helene, in The New Yorker, Benjamin Wallace Wells wrote, "Several weeks ago, Kavanaugh promised that he would be independent as a judge. Now he's saying that he believed he was the target of a liberal smear campaign. The line between judicial independence and partisan politics is thin, often illusory, a pretense really, but rigorously preserved. This afternoon, that line disappeared entirely." I mean, he even brought up the Clintons in his testimony yesterday. What are your thoughts on that and how that's being covered?
Well, this goes back to some things that both Sarah and Jody have already said, right? What people in Washington tend to cover this as, you know, a he said, she said often, and who's on top and who's not, right? And in fact, it's been very obvious from the get-go that that Kavanaugh is a partisan. He's been a partisan from the beginning. But there's this sense that somehow we're supposed to take him as a tabula rasa, that he's a blank slate, right, and he can say, "Oh, I will give this, you know, give things fair hearings." And we are supposed to go, "Oh, okay, we believe that." When in fact, it's been very clear to anybody who looked that he was a longtime partisan and that there's no way he was going to go on to the Supreme Court as anything but that. And yesterday, of course, just brought that home, right? You know, there was no surprise that this turns out to be the guy who pursued Vince Foster theories of, you know, that he was murdered and did not commit suicide, that he, you know, asked, you know, wanted to ask Bill Clinton questions that if I began to read them off in the air, you would begin to bleep me out. This is somebody who is deeply enmeshed in a 25-year conspiracy-type thinking. I mean, there's no two ways about that. And that this was not highlighted more is kind of a, you know, an embarrassment to everybody who covered this.
Well, and Sarah, I mean, you just wrote a piece for the Washington Post called "To Trump, Kavanaugh's Testimony About Religious Liberty Made Him Worth the Pick." You have also done extensive coverage on the extreme right and groups like the Federalist Society. And this is another question, you know, why aren't these groups getting more attention? Politico reports that Kavanaugh's name was added in October 2017 to a short list of Supreme Court candidates. The Federalist Society Executive Director Leonard Leo and Public Policy Center President Ed Whelan have been working with the Judicial Crisis Network on this. They've raised $15 million. Now, I was watching the cable shows the other day, and it was, you know, Kavanaugh nonstop, and I thought, the host and the guests are not bringing up the Judicial Crisis Network or the Federalist Society. Well, guess what ad ran pretty much regularly during the breaks? Judicial Crisis Network ads painting Kavanaugh as a wholesome family man. So what about this angle, Sarah?
Well, I think that for a lot of the media coverage of this, I think they function on an assumption that the left and the right have sort of equivalent structures in place. So that, like, you know, there's a conservative group called the Federalist Society, and there's a liberal group called, say, the American Civil Liberties Union. And so it operates on this assumption that, like, both sides have some mechanism for pushing their preferred judicial nominees, and there's really nothing wrong with this. But as I wrote in the piece that I did for The Nation earlier this month, you know, there's a lot of dark money that flows into the Judicial Crisis Network and to the Federalist Society, meaning money that we don't know who the contributors are. So we're talking about tens of millions of dollars where we don't know who the donor is and what their interest is in promoting the Federalist Society or the Judicial Crisis Network's ideas. And so the Judicial Crisis Network's job, basically, is to package and create an image for the judicial nominees that the Federalist Society has put forth and who Leonard Leo has taken to the Trump administration, and present them in, like, the most positive possible light. So, you know, so that's why we saw those ads from the Judicial Crisis Network that presented Kavanaugh as a good family man who goes to church and coaches his daughter's basketball team, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they came out of the box with that, like, even before anybody in the public knew about these sexual assault allegations. They had already packaged Kavanaugh up as this image without addressing, you know, his, like Helene said, his role in the Starr investigation or his role in the Bush White House. You know, he played a very political role, which runs counter to his self-image as an impartial jurist.
And as you write, Posner, Sarah, that Kavanaugh is only 53 years old. I mean, he could be on the court for decades and really tipping the balance of power, overturning the right to abortion, expanding religious exemptions to civil rights laws, reproductive health services. A lot of people say birth control will eventually also be at play. Sarah, what else? What would you add to that list?
Well, I think that in terms of Kavanaugh's views on issues related to reproductive rights and LGBT rights and church-state separation, he's definitely of the mindset that, you know, a lot of things that have long been considered by the court to be a violation of the Establishment Clause and church-state separation are not, and that religious freedom for people who object to things like abortion or LGBT rights should be more expansive. So this is very much in line with Trump's promises to his Christian right base, and is further evidence of sort of the politicized nature of the Kavanaugh nomination, that this is about pleasing a base as opposed to picking the best, most impartial jurist. Hmm.
Jody, what would you add?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I'm not sure that that hasn't been true for a while. I think, you know, this is we're seeing in the extreme, in terms of personality, what I think has been packaged for a long time on the court. I don't think we can take this incident as dramatic as it is in terms of the assault allegations and other things away from the kind of person John Roberts is and was packaged as, or Neil Gorsuch, or, you know, any of these others, or the Merrick Garland episode. You know, it's clear that the right thinks it should control the courts no matter what, and they do find these people who have extremely outward facing pleasingness, if you will, but then they really have extraordinarily radical ideas insofar as the rights of others who are not white and wealthy go. And so I see Trump as the sort of natural conclusion of a lot of what's come before. And I think, again, it's in part because, in part, not only, but in part because not only does the media fail to really effectively address these things the way that need to be done, but also the media, you know, ecosystem has collapsed. And so not many people are getting very good information in many places. And it's really problematic for the country as a whole.
Helene, what would you add?
I would add, to go one thing about Kavanaugh is I would add, you know, his take on worker rights is also extremely concerning, and I think that has to be highlighted. That, you know, it seems like in every case that has come before him where it's an issue versus of an employer versus a worker, he has ruled for the employer in a way that is sort of staggering and without judicial, real judicial precedent. There's a particular emphasis on one case, the SeaWorld case, where a female trainer was killed by a whale who had killed other trainers in the past. And SeaWorld had been found to have not taken proper care to make sure this did not happen again. And he claimed that animal trainer is a profession on par with race car driver and other football player and other dangerous professions. And this wasn't even, he was the minority opinion, and it was not, it did not go anywhere. But it tells us something about where he's going. In terms of the bigger media issue, I agree very much with what I think it was Jody said about the greater spectrum out there, and I think it's a really, really important point. Something we don't totally realize in the big cities sometimes is how complete the breakdown has been in the news media, especially at the local newspaper level. Mm-hmm. And it is apparent, it is sort of staggering. And it has really reached the point where it's even now in the suburbs, right outside surrounding the major cities. So, for example, in New York City, where I am, you know, Westchester County is barely covered at this point, which is, you know, a huge area, and Rockland County. Mm. I think one of the things we forget is that local news is not just covering local news, though it's important. It's also conveying local reporters turn up at local events, right? They turn up at local city council meetings. They turn up at, you know, at high school football games and so on. And it's pretty hard to demonize the woman or guy who turns up at the high school football game, right? But when that no longer happens, you're suddenly demonizing somebody from afar. Mm. And it's a much easier thing to do, and it's been a real issue in the system. And the economic model for it at this point has collapsed, and there's very few efforts being made to bring back the local journalism model at this point. And I would argue it might in some ways be the most important part of the whole thing.
Hmm. We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line but wanted to say that Ted Cruz talked about the suffering of Kavanaugh and his family, but not the millions of women and others who will be suffering. And given the nature of this sort of he said, she said reporting, I mean, even this morning on NPR in their, you know, top hole, their top guest, it was 7:10 a.m., they brought on a conservative blogger, writer for the Daily Beast, Matt Lewis, for an 8-minute conversation about how, you know, Blasey Ford was believable, but so is Kavanaugh, and so he should be confirmed. So given the nature of this he said, she said coverage, and really, its long-term implications. Sarah, from here on out, I mean, how do you think reporters should be covering these issues?
Well, I think that they should have some understanding of how the process works. I think, for example, on MSNBC yesterday, they had a number of very good guests who were former prosecutors. or former, you know, administration officials who understand how the background check process works, right? And so they were saying, look, you know, there's a way of settling or getting at least more information on this, he said, she said, if that's how you're viewing this, do the FBI background check, do more investigating, bring Mark Judge, subpoena Mark Judge. I mean, it's not that complicated. So, like, if any reporter is just saying, oh, well, you know, let's throw up our hands, as he said, she said, they're not paying any attention to the way this process would work out if the Republicans didn't make the deliberate decision to steamroll it instead of following that process.
And now Julie Swetnick is speaking. She gave an interview to Showtime's The Circus. And Swetnick has alleged that Kavanaugh participated in what they're calling gang rape, where they're lining up outside of a bedroom where, quote, numerous boys were, quote, waiting their turn with a girl inside the room. Swetnick said she was raped at one of the parties and believed she had been drugged, but did not directly accuse Kavanaugh of raping her. So here's another woman that's publicly speaking now. Jody, what are your thoughts?
Well, just to add to the intrigue going on here, apparently there are some holdup and something happening with Jeff Flake. So perhaps there are some changes. I don't know what's happening right now, but there's a bunch of intrigue happening at the Capitol as we speak. I think...
Jody, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so I'm checking this on Twitter. Let's see. Natalie Evans is tweeting. She's a journalist with the Daily Mirror, says Senator Jeff Flake is not back in the room. The vote should be happening now. We'll see. And we're going to go over to the coverage as soon as it begins. Helene, what would you add, just in terms of the reporting from here on out, and now that this Julie Swetnick is now speaking, I mean, who knows what's going to happen in the coming days with other accusers?
Right. Well, I think it's a twofold issue. I think first, you know, there was not adequate vetting of Kavanaugh from the get-go. And it's an issue that goes well beyond the, you know, the alleged sexual assault charges, right, or claims. You know, the White House refused to release huge amounts of documents from his time in the Bush administration. There's still questions back to his days with the Starr investigation. So I think in some ways the most recent charges are simply a piece of that. And in some ways, you know, it's the one that has grabbed the most attention for fairly obvious reasons. I mean, this is, you know, this is goes beyond politics. It speaks to moral character. And obviously, if the Republicans were serious about this vetting, the other vetting would have occurred, right? And there would have been an FBI investigation of the current round of claims, because that is what you do. That is procedure. That is normal. This is what should happen. And to me, again, to go back to what I think I said earlier, it's just a sign of the greater breakdown. Mm-hmm. There were norms that were followed, and how you go forward when one side is not adhering to norms, I don't quite know the answer to.
Right.
I'm not sure how you deal with that. I'm not sure how you address that. I don't know how you speak about that without sounding vaguely hysterical, right? Mm. Especially because we've allowed it to go on for so long. It has been normalized in a way. It's been the, you know, frog in the boiling pot, right?
Right.
And, you know, the, as I think it was Sarah who said, you know, in Washington there's been this kind of assumption that, well, there's the Federalist Society on one side and the ACLU on the other, which is utterly ridiculous, right?
Right.
These are
right.
not equivalent
right.
in any way whatsoever. And so to suddenly come in and say, wait a second, stop, we have to talk about this, is very hard for the media process. It's a new way of thinking. And keep in mind, you know, a lot of people in the media don't, you know, have for a long time have not believed that.
Mm.
And it's very hard to suddenly shift course.
Helene, it's such a great point, because we do so many shows about corruption, legalized bribery, money in politics. Both parties take a lot of money, far too much money. Both parties are very connected to Wall Street. There are clear differences. And one of them is that they tend to play by very different rules. And it's the media, it seems like they're so afraid to just say that. It always has to be Washington is broken without talking about how it became so broken.
Right.
Right. Exactly.
And it goes back to the hypocrisy point, and I've been just sort of harping on this in my recent columns. I feel like my 15-year-old, right? You know how teenagers get so obsessed with adult hypocrisy. But I think it's a really important point that it has been allowed to go on for the longest time. Mm-hmm. And it goes back 20-plus years, you know, where nobody could call out George W. Bush for his National Guard service, but somehow John Kerry was swift-voted, right? And nobody really knew how to deal with this. And I think there's just a point at which it has to be stated that this is an ongoing pattern. This is a pattern that is, you know, sort of enabled by traditional media norms of giving both sides of the story, and that we are in a period of massive change, in part because the media economic system is breaking down, in part because, you know, the existence of social media is what is feeding into that breakdown, both causing it and allowing people to get things into the discourse that were not previously in the discourse. And it just shifts the dialogue, and nobody really knows how to deal with that. As I was putting it in a conversation with somebody a few weeks ago, it used to be you would have to really hunt down conspiracy theories, right? You couldn't just stumble into something. It was hard work, and now it's click, click, and there it is.
Mm-hmm.
But that actually was 10 years ago. Now you don't even have to click, click. It just turns up on your media feed if one of your friends is into it.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, on those points, what would you add?
Well, I think that it became increasingly difficult for the media with a straight face to cover the hearing yesterday as giving equal weight to the Republicans' claim that Ford was either making it up or crazy or mistaken or didn't remember stuff, versus, you know, Kavanaugh defending his honor. Why would somebody who's a trained psychologist put herself through what she put herself through yesterday? I mean, they basically proved the point of why people like in her position don't want to put themselves through that and wouldn't come forward because of the way that they treated her and because of the way that they sort of gave equal weight to, well, you know, sure, you know, she thinks she's telling the truth, but she's probably mistaken, and poor Brett Kavanaugh is defending his honor. I mean, I really think that that has got to become more and more difficult for the press to just cover that sort of straight up. I mean, I think we're still obviously seeing some coverage like that, but I think there has to be some kind of reckoning about this, you know, this both sides-ism, whataboutism, you know, where the Republicans try to make it seem like, well, there was this vast left, I mean, not just the Republicans, Kavanaugh himself, implying that there was some vast left-wing conspiracy against his nomination. We have to, like, reckon with all of that, you know, when we're reporting. I mean, I'm a reporter. You have to reckon with somebody might tell you something, but if it's preposterous, you have to make that clear. You don't just sort of let it sit, put it out there and let it sit there.
Sarah Posner is an investigative reporter, a reporting fellow at the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, and author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Helene Olin is a contributor to the Washington Post's Plumline blog and author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. And Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewired.News, an online publication focusing on health, rights, and justice. And this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. We were supposed to cut over to the Senate Judiciary Committee vote. And here's what's happening. USA Today writes, shortly after announcing he would vote in favor of confirming Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, Senator Jeff Flake was cornered in an elevator by a sexual assault survivor who pleaded with him to do the right thing. Visibly shaken, he left for the hearing room. As fellow members of the committee spoke, Flake tapped his friend, Democrat Senator Chris Coons, on the shoulder. That set off a flurry of quiet conversations outside the room as senators continued to deliver remarks, suggesting they were discussing a delay. So, I mean, the Democrats are calling for a delay. It looks like they're talking to Jeff Flake. Helene, the vote was supposed to be happening right now, but something's going on.
We clearly don't know what is going on. It seems like there's pressure being put on Flake in some way, but by whom and how seems to be a mystery.
Yeah, Jody, you brought this to our attention. I know you're checking Twitter in real time because things are changing, but what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm hoping that, in fact, that at this point this woman did get through to him, because he was in a very personal space with her. You know, it's different to be in a very personal interaction with someone who's pleading with you to listen. And while I've seen him brush that aside and do other things before, as I recounted with the story about Eddie, I think that maybe this time it got to him, because he's kind of, you know, the Uber person who's always saying he's going to be a renegade and do something different and never does. So I don't know, you know, what to think about this. I suspect he's being lobbied outside the room very heavily by both sides. But you can never count on Jeff Flake, unless this is the first time, you know, he might make a different decision. I've just seen the movie of Jeff Flake, you know, making sort of pronouncements and then falling back into line too many times now to get hopes up that something might happen. I could see, and I think it would be a really healthy thing, him coming in and saying, I'm not going to vote yes until we do an FBI investigation, which I actually think is the most effective, principled way out for some of these Republicans. And one would think that they would say, you know what, we want an FBI investigation to vet all of these charges. After that, we will look at the evidence and then we'll vote. And that, to me, would be a principled stand.
Especially as other women say that they want to testify.
Exactly.
So CNN is reporting that Flake disappeared into a back room, and a number of people are quietly talking. The vote was supposed to happen a few minutes ago, but it's being delayed. So I'm glad, because we're able to continue to talk with all of you, but we'll see what happens. We'll check in real time. Can we go back and talk about Kavanaugh? I mean, I think a lot of people were really taken aback when he came out so angry. I mean, his face was red. And do any of you have any idea how this decision was made? Who coached him? Because yesterday, the Washington Post, Robert Costa tweeted, quote, Trump is riveted and telling people this is why I nominated him in a positive way, talking to lots of people inside the White House about how he likes how Kavanaugh is fighting back. Well, of course he does. But Helene, Sarah, Jody, any idea? Have you read anything about who coached him?
Well, I think it was widely reported that he was at the White House, since the Washington Post broke the story about Ford's allegations, that he was at the White House, huddling at the White House with, we don't know. That was an important question, I think, that didn't get asked by the Democrats yesterday, because we know that, for example, you know, his friend Ed Whalen hatched this crazy conspiracy theory about it being somebody else, you know, the infamous Twitter thread with the Zillow listings and the floor plans, where, you know, he basically accused another friend of Ford's of having committed the assault. So we don't know who exactly coached him at the White House. I mean, I think it was, like I said, widely reported by White House reporters that he was there, you know, for days, kind of holed up, you know, getting, I think the term of art is murder board, getting murder boarded. You know, I think that that was something relevant that the Democrats could have asked. They didn't ask him about Whalen at all, and whether he had any knowledge of this, advanced knowledge of that Twitter thread that Whalen put out there. You know, and it didn't even come up, even as Republicans were making insinuations that perhaps this was a case of mistaken identity on Ford's part. So I think that there's some criticism to be leveled at the Democrats, too. I know they only had 5 minutes each yesterday, and that was a function of Grassley's decision, executive decision, to do it that way. But there were lots of things they could have gotten on the record and tried to pin down
Kavanaugh's testimony on the record that they didn't.
And can we also talk about the drinking? Because Kavanaugh went on Fox and said he never drank to excess. One of his Yale classmates, Lynn Brooks, and I'm reading this from The Week, went on Chris Cuomo's show on CNN and said, yeah. quote, "I'll tell you, Chris, I watched the whole hearing and a number of my Yale colleagues and I were extremely disappointed in Kavanaugh's characterization of himself and the way he evaded his excessive drinking question and was lying to the committee." Lynn Brooks went on to say, "There is no doubt in my mind that while at Yale he was a big partier, often drank to excess, and there had to be a number of nights where he does not remember." She said she can almost guarantee he doesn't remember a night she witnessed where he was stumbling drunk in a ridiculous costume saying dumb things to pledge a fraternity. So what about that, Helene? I mean, how should this be dealt with?
Well, I think it goes to a bigger issue again, that he lies about things that can be clearly be disproven, right? There's no question, it appears, that he was drinking to excess in the past. We don't really know about the present, right? Though it does raise questions. Why lie about it, though, right? I mean, you know, I was in college in the 1980s in New England. I assure you, pretty much everybody around me drank to excess, male or female, at some point, mm-hmm. me included. There's no shame to that, really. So why not cop to it? It doesn't totally add up. I mean, there's similar things in terms of how he's handled his finances. You know, and this is something that really still deserves more attention. He was in a lot of debt until about a year ago. When did it go away? How did it go away? There's quite possibly an innocent explanation for how it went away. I've pointed this out on Twitter, and Stephanie Mensimer at Mother Jones recently wrote an article speculating on it, too, that there was potentially family help. But why not admit to that if that's the case? It doesn't seem to make sense. It doesn't add up. And I think one of the things that's going on here, to just keep bring this into the bigger picture again, is allegations take off because they tend to feed into people's pre-existing doubts. And I think from the get-go, there was a lot about Kavanaugh that didn't make sense to people, didn't feel comfortable, didn't feel quite right. And there were just pieces of him as a potential nominee that were missing. And I think this has all kind of coalesced at this point. And then, of course, the sexual assault allegations are horrific in and of themselves, and they have triggered a massive wave from women who are discouraged from talking about this stuff still, more than a year after, almost a year after the Me Too movement really went off, and how common this was during the 1980s as well. Mm-hmm.
Well, we just got some breaking news from CNN. Dana Bash is reporting that there are serious conversations underway about how and whether a brief additional investigation could be done by the FBI and a vote delayed by no more than a week. So that is that's the latest. Sarah?
Well, I think that this would be very good news for everyone involved, and I would imagine if Judge Kavanaugh believes himself to be innocent of these charges, he would welcome it. This is what the Democrats were saying all along, and the fact that the Republicans had to be, rushed this thing and had to be pushed into a corner about it is just kind of absurd. They could have just said this from the get-go, avoided yesterday until there was more evidence, more facts and evidence come forward through some kind of further investigation, and the Republicans totally bungled this. But although, this would be a positive result if this is what they're going to agree to today.
And it looks like, are we going live? Okay, we might be going live in just a couple of minutes. And so if we do, I just want to thank all of you. Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of Rewire.news, an online publication focusing on all of these issues, health, rights, and justice. They do incredible work. Sarah Posner is a reporting fellow at the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Helene Olin is a contributor to the Washington Post Plumline blog and author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Okay, we thought we were going live, but now we are not. It just keeps changing. So, Jody, what are your thoughts about all this? I mean, it sounds like perhaps this woman got to flake, and, maybe they realized, we've got to do this investigation.
I think so. It may well be. I think, you know, here's what I think. Going back to this question of coaching, who coached him and what have you, I think this is actually who this guy is. Mm. He is a partisan person from the get-go. He worked in a highly partisan White House. He worked on a highly, highly partisan investigation. And he was so evasive and so misleading, even yesterday and then before that. I think it's raised some questions in some of these folks' minds that they cannot put to rest, and that the confrontation with the woman yesterday may well have been the thing that pushed Flake over the edge. Now, I don't know whether or not people in Arizona are also calling, you know, Flake's office or what have you, but I do think that it goes back to the whole issue of who he really is. And it seems to me, and I'm sort of rolling this out as a thought process, someone who's capable of blackout drunk drinking, hasn't accepted ever that he did that, and has this sort of web of lies he seems to tell, is really a Trump Jr., right? He can't tell a truth because it would unravel all of the other lies. And I think that's who that guy is. I think he's angry. I think he's entitled. I think he's got some sort of problems internally. I don't know what they are. And he's got a past that he does not want uncovered. And I think that's what we saw yesterday.
Well, and going back to the Federalist Society, Sarah, a couple of outlets are reporting that the Federalist Society, many of the members do not like Trump, but when they hand over the list, he appoints the judges. And so they're willing to kind of turn the other cheek because they're getting exactly what they want. And Brett Kavanaugh was at the top of their list. Okay, so it looks like they are calling for a vote. So I want to thank Jody Jacobson, Sarah Posner, and Helene Olin. I'm really glad we got to spend more time with you all. Thanks for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Could ask a question of Senator Flake. Does your amendment include continuing the investigation during this period of time?
If I can respond, there is no amendment. I'm simply stating, and the discussion that we had between us all is that I would hope, and I think we had some agreement before, that the Democrats who have been, I think, justifiably uncomfortable moving ahead could publicly, in an effort to bring this country together, say that we would feel better. I'm not expecting them to vote yes, but not to complain that an FBI investigation has not occurred. This is what I'm trying to do. This country's being ripped apart here, and we've got to make sure that we do due diligence. I think this committee has done a good job, but I do think that we can have a short pause and make sure that the FBI can investigate. My understanding is that some of us would have to, and I'm prepared to do it, make a request to the White House to ask the FBI to do that investigation. It would be short and limited in scope to the current allegations that have been made.
Mr. Chairman.
But I would just encourage the Democrats who we talked to before to endorse that kind of thing, that we can then move on.
Mr. Chairman.
This is KLW San Francisco. We'll be continuing our live coverage as reported by NPR and then live coverage of the Senate Judiciary meeting. 1A will be resumed in progress depending on the conclusion of this meeting.
To the Senate floor, and yet Jeff Flake